Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay, great. Well, I'm very pleased to be here. I've had a wonderful week touring the Maritimes. Incredibly beautiful. I think we put on 2,500 kilometers in the last few days. It's especially meaningful for me to be giving this lecture in the name of Dr. Ransom Myers, because at this moment on Earth, it's a very sensitive time. I think that the fate of our species and of the planet perhaps are in a balance that depends a lot on what we do next. And it's a difficult time to be a biologist with children, because scientists understand what terms like ocean acidification and melting polar caps mean. We may not fully understand it, but we certainly understand the ramifications of it. And so I did not intend to be in the position I'm in today, to be controversial. I went up and found an incredibly beautiful place to live in British Columbia that was amongst the killer whales that I wanted to learn from. I was modeling my life after Jane Goodall's, but I only wanted to live the first few chapters of her book and her life. But I noticed as a girl that all these books had three parts. One was going out and learning how to live in the wilderness and all the incredible things you learn every time you encounter the animal you're working with. And then you're faced with a situation that you have to do something about. Salmon, I barely noticed them when I went to British Columbia, other than if I was eating them. But I was studying a salmon predator. And I have come to see this animal as a power cord. They go out to the open Pacific, they collect the energy of the sunlight hitting that water, and they carry it back to the coastline on a schedule, and they defy gravity and take it up into the hills. I tell people in Vancouver, when it's blowing southeast, you're breathing oxygen made by trees fed by salmon. The connection is that close. And I feel a lot of my work right now is to explain the birds and the bees to people. We are part of a living system. We are a mammal, and we depend on animals like this. The community that I chose to settle in is a floathouse community called Echo Bay. There was about 200 people there when I arrived in 1984. No telephones, no roads, no stores. We did have a one-room school, and so it was just the right balance for me as a young researcher with a baby, and it was in protected waters. I went there to study the orca, or killer whale, fascinating, fascinating animal. And in the course of that work, I found myself turning to fishermen more and more, because they're salmon predators that talk. And so I was able to learn a lot from them about why the whales were showing up at particular times or how they were even swimming the inlets. They were an enormous resource to me. When Ransom came to visit, he was about to publish a paper, actually with Jennifer Ford, his student, on the impact of salmon farms around the world. It's a very important paper because he found that wherever salmon farms go into the ocean, wild salmon tip into exceptional decline. And this paper has been used many times to tell people that, yes, the problems you're having in your area are actually similar to those elsewhere. In 2001, a fisherman brought me a juvenile salmon covered in sea lice. And you can see the lice here on these juvenile fish. He was upset because he had guests from Scotland who were fishing with him because of what he called the sea lice plagues in Scotland had wiped out the sea trout and the wild Atlantic salmon. And when this fisherman brought me these fish, he said, "Are these sea lice? Can you figure this out?" And that was in 2001. And for the next 9 years, I studied sea lice, gradually abandoning the killer whale research altogether. Sea lice are a natural crustacean. They occur on salmon, but salmon are the whole planet. They don't actually want to kill the salmon. But the problem is when they get on little fish like this, this slice is way too big for this fish, and it's creating these holes and simply eating it to death. We looked at everything about the lice because, as many of you are aware of, direct proof in the biological world is almost always unavailable. And so when you're dealing with a problem like sea lice from salmon farms eating juvenile wild salmon to the point that their populations are crashing, it's very hard to prove it to the media, to the public. There's always a way to for the opposition to fight you on it. But we did a number of studies. This one I co-authored with Dr. Rick Rutledge of Simon Fraser University, and it looks at the presence of sea lice and juvenile salmon in three different years when salmon farms were bare, present, and farm salmon were not present in that year. We looked at areas in the same year where there were farms and there were no farms. We looked at what happens when you drug the lice, and we looked at what happens when the water temperature is warmer, the water temperature is cooler. We got quite sophisticated with it. We're lucky that we're living in an inlet system like this, and that's the direction the juvenile salmon migrate, and this is quite a large river. And so we simply looked at 100 fish at all those stars several times, doing the whole route, and you've got a farm here and here and here and here, and sometimes here. And sea lice are really easy to study because they change their body shape every few days for the first 30 days, and the first stage only lasts a few hours. So what we found was that as you approach the farm, lice numbers slowly come up, and then as you go past the farms, they do some dips, but they remain quite high. And this is true in all the trials. These papers were published in many scientific journals. The peer review process was very tough for us because the journals kept sending in, of course, to the people who disagreed, which is a good idea. So we're often asked to submit the raw data so that they could look at it for themselves. But we continually got published. However, it was not entirely successful in communicating the problem. The problem is that salmon farms break natural laws. But instead of allowing salmon to move, they hold them stationary. In the wild fish comes home, they go in the river, the sea lice die of fresh water. It's a beautiful system. The juveniles come out in the spring. There's no adult salmon to speak of in the area. They go to sea, they grow and grow, and by the time they meet the wild fish coming by, they're robust fish clad in armor of scales, and they can take a few lice. But the situation with the salmon farms is the wild fish come in, they infect the farms. The wild fish go in and do their duty. They die, the lice die. But the lice breed on the farms. And the way lice reproduce is they hatch, and they have to swim for a week without the equipment to get on the salmon. So that means mom's fish is way long gone by the time that little juvenile louse grows the equipment to latch onto a fish. And so the lice are generally left behind. But in the captive situation where everybody's going around in a circle, the lice are easily finding a place to settle, and then there's another generation and another generation, another generation, and by springtime, the calculations say billions of larval lice are coming out of the farms as the juveniles pass. Two Pacific salmon really gamble on there not being lice. They don't even bother to grow scales before they leave the rivers, the pink and chum salmon. So they're just completely destroyed by the lice. However, the farms are still there, and they attempted to deal with this problem with drugs, which is having a temporary fix right now in British Columbia. It's not working so well here. But what I want to talk to you about is the Cohen Commission and the Fraser River sockeye. So the Fraser River sockeye to British Columbia are an extremely important run of salmon. They can be as much as 30 million. Historically, they might have been 100 million. And they Since the 1990s, these fish have become unpredictable. All the values that used to be plugged into mathematical models, such as the size of the fish, the number of the fish when they leave the river, the water temperature, the plankton, these things used to work for predicting the return a few years later. And so the Pacific Salmon Commission could tell the fishermen, okay, we're going to have approximately this many fish, and the guys could all get ready to go fishing. These scientists are very embarrassed now that they can no longer predict these fish. They remain predictable in Alaska, but not in British Columbia. And so the Cohen Commission was called in 2009, and the governments were asked to submit all the documents that might possibly have anything to do with the impact on the Fraser sockeye. One of the very strange things about what has been going on with these fish is that a lot of them have been dying before they spawn. They get all the way back to the Fraser River, they get all the way back to their spawning grounds, and then they die. Pre-spawn mortality is killing millions of Fraser sockeye. In 2002, $72 million were lost to commercial fishermen. And there was an additional problem with the river in that at the counting light at Mission, at the very low part of the river, fish would be counted that never appeared in the upper reaches, which goes as far as 900 kilometers. And this is called in-river loss, and in some years, up to 90% of the sockeye that got in the river never even made it to the spawning ground. So clearly a big problem, but it's an interesting problem with fish because you actually got to see the fish. Generally, fish just go missing, but these fish you could see, and I, as a participant of the Cohen Commission, could read the 500,000 documents that ended up in that commission. And so I tracked what the biologists in DFO were trying to figure out with these fish, and they said, man, they're dying of everything. They might lose a whole spawning ground, but they all seem to be dying of different things. So it's kind of like a murder mystery. And the first remarkable thing about this is the timing. So this is the productivity of of the Fraser sockeye. The Fraser sockeye is made up of a lot of runs, a lot of tributaries. Like I said, it's 900 kilometers long and it's huge. It takes up most of British Columbia. And right there, that's where the decline began. The productivity is how many adults return compared to how many parents spawn that run. Now, as you all know, by itself, that number means very little, although it's dramatic. There's a lot of things that happened in that year. But then we looked at what runs are affected. So the orange bubbles are showing a below average run, and the larger the bubble, the further below. And the green bubble is showing above average. This graph was produced by the Pacific Salmon Commission, and these are all different stocks within the Fraser River. Interesting pattern started there. So in trying to figure this out, of course, you wonder, well, what about the green guys, the Harrison? What is different about them than all the others? Well, biology is always messy, and so unfortunately they have two very significant things that are different. But the red ones, here's where the early Stuarts go, they come all the way down here and up through there, feeding in from all these tributaries. And these are salmon farms. The green bubbles is this blue line here, the Harrison. The Harrison also go to sea without spending a year in the lake. So the big difference in my view of what that means is the red guys, the babies are sitting in the lakes, and here come the adults, fresh from the ocean, and they mingle with them. But the Harrison are gone. When the Harrison come back, their babies are gone. So that contact between adult generation and juvenile generation does not occur with the Harrison. So DFO decided by about 2005 they would have to do something about this. They had to figure out now not only how many fish were coming in and also what stocks were coming in, because DFO does extensive work up in Johnson Straits, where they do purse seines, and then they quickly run the DNA, And if they've got the right composition of salmon coming down to the Fraser, enough of the tributaries that are big are there, they'll open a fishery. But now they had to not only do that, they had to figure out which ones were going to spawn, how many of these were going to spawn, because they were getting, you know, fewer salmon on the spawning grounds than to replace the generation. And so they tasked this laboratory in Nanaimo, British Columbia. It's the Pacific Biological Station. This is Dr. Christy Miller and her all-girl team. And they use genomic profiling. And I really hope more people pick up this tool because it's phenomenal. We should be using it in our healthcare. What they did was they caught these fish in Johnson Straits, that sockeye there coming out of the Seine. They took a little clip of the gill, they tagged it, and they let it go. And then they ran a genomic profile on that clip of gill. And what a genomic profile does is it reads the immune response of the fish. It can't see what the fish is fighting, but it can see what tools it's picked up. And it's a series of switches. These guys definitely deserve the Order of Canada. Because they figured it out. So here's her language and what they read. And the first thing that she noticed was, okay, the healthy fish that spawned had one pattern. The ones that were dying and did not make it back to the river or were lying dead on the spawning grounds without spawning, they had a different pattern. That was huge. Because remember, all those other biologists who were actually looking at the fish couldn't figure it out because the fish weren't giving enough clues. But then the shocker came. The dying sockeye all had the same pattern. It was consistent with a retroviral infection, a class of viruses that often causes cancer. This was unexpected. Everybody thought she was going to find out that they had run out of energy, that they had not fed properly, and at the last moment they'd run out of energy. I read everything that she had in the commission. All these documents are now public, but they certainly weren't when the Fraser sockeye crashed in 2009. There was a big invited meeting of scientists dealing with the Fraser sockeye, and they invited me because I know about fish farms, and that was something that they wanted to consider. Nobody from her lab actually talked, so we never heard about this. Granted, this is pretty bad news for DFO, cancer-causing viral disease, maybe associated with wild salmon declines. But DFO, so what Miller did was she looked up, okay, the switches that were flicking, and this is a very new science, mind you, and it's particularly new in fish. She's the only person really doing it in salmon. But it looked like the switches were saying brain tumors, leukemia, retroviral infection, cancer. So she looks around, what viruses fit that? And there's only one that occurs in the Pacific. And DFO had named it. It was plasmacytoid leukemia caused by the salmon leukemia virus. It destroyed the fish's immune system. And that's why, perhaps, all these fish were dying of something that looked different. They did tests with this. They found it in the majority of fish farms. And they challenged sockeye and chinook with it. And they all became infected, the sockeye and chinook. All the sockeye died and most of the chinook, but only 1 in 10 Atlantic salmon got it. The salmon farming industry at that point in the mid-90s, or a little bit later, switched over to Atlantics in the late 90s. But they maintained a few chinook farms on the Fraser sockeye migration route. A PhD thesis done on it said, said that a neoplastic disease could have profound regulatory effects on the salmon farming industry. Neoplastic meaning tumor causing. Yeah, definitely. Particularly one that kills all the wild sockeye that are challenged with it. But these effects never happened. There was no regulatory impact. The salmon farming industry remained on the Fraser sockeye migration route, even though the Fraser sockeye tilted in decline at that moment. And it wasn't until years later that a scientist comes along and out of the blue, she's tasked to figure this out, why these fish are dying, and her compass is all over the place, but pretty soon it's just like right in on salmon leukemia virus. So here's Vancouver Island. I live up here. Vancouver's down here. And this is the salmon farming industry, how it's situated in southern British Columbia. And these are very narrow passages. During the Cohen Commission, Dr. Kyle Garver testified at the commission, he's a DFO virologist, that a single farm here with a viral outbreak of IHN, different virus, if it was losing about 30% of the fish, would be producing 650 billion viral particles per hour per farm. And when he modeled it, it filled the channels like that. And so here come the Fraser sockeye and others, and they swim right through that. The way salmon breathe is they open their mouths, they take water in, they pass it over their gills, and so whatever's in the water is coming into contact with their bloodstream. So whatever is happening on the salmon farms, these fish are being exposed to it quite intimately. Dr. Miller was very careful not to talk too much about this connection with salmon aquaculture, but finally in 2010, in April, she said, I would like to test the farm salmon. Because unfortunately, when DFO did all the research on salmon leukemia virus, they never sequenced it, they never visualized it. So we have no roadmap back to it. We only have what they said in the papers, the physical symptoms of it, and the general characteristics. But she wasn't allowed to do that. She was not allowed to see if these fish have the same genomic profile as the Fraser sockeye, and she has not been allowed to this day. When 10 million Fraser sockeye went missing, she was not allowed to talk to the press. She published in the Journal of Science about this, and she was not allowed to talk to the media. Her work was misrepresented. Genomics, genetics, the media went on about the genetics. They said that the genetics of the Fraser sockeye is weak, and that's why they're dying. So it makes a person wonder, if the salmon farming industry was not in the pathway of these fish, what would have happened to them? That's virus number one. Virus number two is salmon influenza, the ISA virus, which is it's a family within the influenza. It is a type of influenza. Scientists I have talked to said it's the most difficult virus they've ever worked with because it is so built for change. And right now I'm tracking this virus. The Cohen Commission revealed a lot of documents, and I searched out infectious salmon anemia virus because this virus started in Norway in 1984. And then suddenly, well, it spread to Scotland, Ireland, Faroe Islands, here. And then 2007, suddenly it erupted in Chile. And it caused $2 billion worth of damage to the salmon farming industry there. And I read about it. They believe it traveled in the eggs. They didn't really respond to it. They saw it a little bit. It was diagnosed here at the Atlantic Veterinary College because they had some extra losses they couldn't explain, and they sent them a sample just to rule out that it was ISA. And then they say it just took off. Nobody had any idea it could travel so fast or be so virulent. And so I began writing to DFO. I've written thousands, over 10,000 pages to DFO on salmon farming, always trying to just, I was of the belief for a long time that if I just lined up the words in the right order, I could communicate the problem. But when I got into the Cohen Commission, I got a chance to see what I was up against. So this is a briefing, confidential, from a veterinary in the province of British Columbia, and it's on infectious salmon anemia, and it was to a minister of agriculture and lands. And he said, the most likely source of ISA in BC is from migrating wild fishes from other regions of the Pacific Ocean, as there is no importation of live Atlantic salmon or eggs to BC. Well, we did have an Atlantic salmon industry at that time, so you wonder how he could say that no live Atlantic salmon eggs had come to BC. But he also mentioned that the presence of ISA would profoundly impact a company's business due to the initial slaughter orders. These were strange statements to have side by side, and I looked into it. So if you simply type eggs DFO into Google, you get this page here. And This box goes from 86 to 2007. And if you count the eggs, when that memo was written, there had been 26 million live Atlantic salmon eggs, presumably alive, brought into British Columbia. When that man was faced with that document on the stand in the Cohen Commission, he said, "The trouble with documents like that is you never know where they're going to turn up." So, explaining something to them, you see what you're up against. So, when I had read all of that, along with a lot of records, so one of the most incredible things that the Cohen Commission did was they got the disease records from the salmon farms. 100 of us got into canoes and paddled for 8 days down the Lower Fraser River with lots of media, and we walked through the streets of Vancouver. We took up a whole street, and it was pouring rain, and we walked into the commission, and we just stood there quietly with like water pooling off of us until Justice Cohen acknowledged us, and we wanted one thing, and that was the disease records from the salmon farms. And he did it. And that's the first region of the world where the disease records of the salmon farms have been made public. And I read them. I read every line several times. They're a stack like that. And in it, there was over 1,000 references to the classic lesions of ISA virus. The man who was actually opening the fish and looking at them thought he was seeing it. But the PCR tests, the tests that actually would detect the virus, they kept apparently coming up negative. So I instructed my lawyer to ask all the parties, do we have ISA virus? And so under oath, DFO scientists said, there has been no indication of ISA or ISA virus on this coast. Dr. Kent, who did a lot of the work on salmon leukemia, said that ISA has not been seen in BC. Dr. Gary Marty with the province, he's the provincial vet who said he thought he saw it 1,000 times, said he had a great deal of confidence that we don't have ISA virus in British Columbia. Claire Backman with Marine Harvest said the level of surveys done in the country of origin, and then again the quarantine and follow-up sampling here in British Columbia, has been successful in preventing any exotic disease, including this particular one. And Peter McKenzie with the other Norwegian company, we're 98% Norwegian salmon farms in BC. He said they've done 5,000 tests, they've never seen it. And then a friend of mine, Dr. Rick Rutledge with Simon Fraser University, gave me a call in last June when I was deep into reading these records and I couldn't tell anybody because it was confidential. He said, "Alex, something's going on with the rivers in Letsaka, I just cannot figure out." They also were in steep decline, and he had looked at the water quality of the lake, the lake floor, the plankton in the inlet, the temperature. Nothing was working out, and by spring of 2010, there were so few sockeye smolts coming out of Rivers Inlet, he was at his wit's end. And I just said, "You know, Rick, I would test for ISA." And he did. And so last October, he gives me a call and he goes, "Are you sitting down? 2 of 48 tested positive for European genotype of ISA virus." This was so shocking to me and to him that we held a press conference. It's not the usual way to release a result, scientific results, but we were hoping that the scientific community would go, "Oh, wow, okay, we better figure this out." Because ISA has this characteristic of coming to a country, simmering, and then becoming extremely virulent. Viruses within an aquaculture environment or any feedlot environment do compete with other viruses and pathogens, and it stimulates virulence. There's no risk for them killing their host. This created quite a bit of a disturbance, and Minister Ashfield said that we had to put Canada's reputation at risk. I really didn't understand what he meant. I know that the salmon farmers were not pleased with it, but I didn't understand this. Mm-hmm. But my reaction to salmon farming from about 1999 is just get up and do the work myself. When I first was hit with salmon farming in my community, I thought it was a great idea. The toxic algae blooms and the Atlantic and the river and the sea lice and the bacterial diseases. I finally realized there was this one word that was in all of the letters that DFR was sent to me. And they said, "Dear Ms. Morton, there is no evidence." Ah, I missed that for years. So there'd be no evidence of sea lice, no evidence of this. And so I went out to get the evidence. So that's how I ended up doing 10 years of sea lice. I went down to the Fraser River with my friend Anissa, who's here. We worked together, and we started looking at salmon that were dying without spawning in the Fraser. We picked up 11. And this big Chinook salmon, strange color of yellow, she had ISA, this sockeye had ISA, and this coho was infected with ISA in the heart. By now, I wasn't even allowed to see these records. They went straight to a lawyer. And the Cohen Commission, which was over, reopened. The lawyers had all gone home. The room was no longer rented. But Justice Cohen saw the significance of this for British Columbia, for the North Pacific, and he reopened the inquiry. And he invited everybody who I had sent samples to. So Dr. Fred Kavenge up here in Prince Edward Island, Dr. Christy Miller, Nell Gagne, I didn't send her samples, but she's in Moncton, she's the DFO reference lab, Dr. R. Nealon at the University of Bergen, Norway. And he found it, she found it, he found it. And Nell said, actually it was a weak positive, but DFO called it a negative. Really, DFO should have said it was inconclusive. But the real surprise is the guy in the back. He had suppressed ISA virus findings. In 2004, an NSERC student from UPI came to the Pacific Biological Station to look for viruses, and she found she got ISA virus positive test results in 100% of the Coltis Lake sockeye. The Coltis Lake sockeye are the most endangered Fraser River sockeye. There has been a Coltis Lake strategy plan that probably you too have been paying for since 1995, and yet nobody knew. The international community didn't know. The CFIA says they didn't know. Certainly the Cohen Inquiry didn't know. This is an internationally reportable disease. And finally, the NSERC student and her husband submitted this paper to the Cohen Commission, and that's how we got to see this. With this came some emails attached to it where DFO was not giving any permission. So, you know, I remember when Ram came to visit me, the reason he came to the Broughton is because he said, I'm gonna wade into this fish farm thing, and if I'm going to fight for it, I want to see the Broughton. I'm going to be able to do a much better job if I've actually seen it. And he said to me, DFO is a criminal organization. And I thought, I was a little shocked by that. But it's a criminal organization, but it doesn't necessarily mean the people in it are criminals, but they are engaging in an activity that is impacting Canada and future generations far too much than it should be. Dr. Miller again. This woman really has guts. DFO prohibited her from testing for ISA, but she knew these hearings were coming, and she had some of the fish that tested positive from Rivers Inlet. And so she quickly began sampling, going through her samples, so that when she got on the stand, she was free to tell us that she found it in a salmon farm. A salmon farm with ISA virus in the Pacific should definitely be culled. And probably here too, and they are culled here. DFO did nothing. It's quite an unbelievable situation that we've got over there. But here's the reason why. Dr. Kim Clotens from the CFIA testified, so if let's say we do find ISA in BC and all of a sudden the markets are closed. Whoa, I had no idea that the markets were involved in this because ISA's been here, Norway and Chile, those markets aren't closed. I'm still not sure what this means. Our role is then to try to renegotiate and negotiate market access to those countries. We'll let them know what we can do and whether we can meet that market access. If we can't meet it, then there will be no trade, basically. That, I suggest, means that there's places purchasing farm salmon and perhaps farm salmon eggs who think they're getting an ISA-free product. And that is dangerous because this is an influenza virus from a farm animal. H1N1, avian flu, all of these things are things that we need to be paying close attention to. It is a notifiable disease. Somebody thinks we should be paying attention to it. So with DFO devoted to trade and Dr. Miller not allowed to test the farm salmon, and I forgot to mention in this because I tried to shorten the talk down, but in 2010, the fish farmers told the province of British Columbia they couldn't come on the farms anymore to test. And so nobody knew what was going on in these farms. There was absolutely no evidence of what was going on in the farms currently. So we went shopping. They're lying there on ice. I actually didn't even think of this, but a friend of mine called me up, and I was like, oh, you're right, yes. So I've looked at 1,300 salmon in British Columbia now, and we treat the farm supermarket situation as if they're just another population, and we keep sampling it. We don't know where they're from, but we don't know where they originated, what hatchery, we don't know what farm they're from, but they're there. We know they were raised in British Columbia. And they've got ISA. They not only have ISA, they have HPR5 strain, which is a virulent Norwegian strain. This work is continuing, and I had thought, that the whole time I was doing the sea lice work, I could see there was a problem with the smolts going by the farms. I could see bugged out eyes, I could see darkened skin, I could see bleeding at the base of the fins. But I thought viruses were beyond my ability. They're not. They're pretty easy to sample for, and then you just gotta find a really good lab that'll work with you. It's very hard for me to find a lab anymore that'll work for me, but there's a couple that are really brave and still on this. At the same time, we're looking for the other two European viruses that are creeping around the world. And one is Piscine Rio virus. It's a Norwegian heart-wasting virus. The Norwegians are afraid that a salmon with that can't swim up a river. Very little is known about it. It was only identified in 2010. It's in almost all the farm salmon we've tested in British Columbia. And it showed up in 100% of the smolts that I tested for my area this spring, which, I now really love that place. I really want those salmon to be there. I do not like the fact that this virus is in there. We don't know what it means, though. And part of what I do with my work, and I did this with the sea lice, is I just start the work. And then grad students come and visiting scientists, and they can really do the test. Somebody needs to be challenging Pacific salmon with this virus to see what their performance is once they're infected. It was interesting listening to the testimony at the Cohen Commission. I heard DFO, I heard university scientists, I heard a lot of people, and the really shocking thing was that almost everyone had a reason to pull their punches, to in some way betray these fish, to be maybe perhaps too careful. The scientists do that, and it's the way we protect ourselves, but if the person who really knows what's going on and knows the animal doesn't interpret it a little bit for the public, then great harm is being done. And one of the lawyers really tried to nail me, and finally he said, "Are you telling me that you are the only pure scientist out there?" And I had to say, perhaps. I went and apologized to all my colleagues after that, but I couldn't let him nail me on that, because what I've done is I don't work for a university, I don't work for the government, I don't have large grants, I live on handouts, and it's something very uncomfortable truth, but if you want to fight something big, you've got to remain really small so no one can find your power lines. And furthermore, I learned a lot about why DFO was doing this. It came down to trade laws. So in 2004, when the fish farm industry, this is just one example, when they begged DFO to be able to import eggs from Iceland, and there was this one little itty-bitty problem with those eggs, and that is that they did not comply with the Canadian Fish Health Protection Regulations, The Director General of Science said, failure to provide permission may trigger a trade challenge by the World Trade Organization. Approval can be granted for such an importation if the risks are deemed acceptable. But that one would be the risk to the industry, which is going to hurt itself with this virus, but is definitely not acceptable to the First Nations or the communities up and down the coast of British Columbia. DFO really has become irrelevant to the guardianship of salmon. Not the individuals perhaps within DFO, but they are complicit within this. About last spring, a bunch of lawyers contacted me and they're like, hey, Alex, are you noticing Bill 37? So this is different than Bill C-38. This is a provincial law that was in the chute to be passed at the very end of our parliamentary sitting. And this is the minister who was pushing it forward, the Minister of Agriculture. And he said, a person must refuse, despite the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act, to disclose that an animal or animal byproduct affected by a notifiable reportable disease is located in a specific place. So ISA virus, a notifiable disease, in a supermarket, such as Superstore, I would have gone to jail for 2 years and a $75,000 fine. And it was a terrifying time. The lawyer said, look, this is going to pass, Alex. And so Anissa and I went down there, and we just sat in the gallery and wanted to stare at them as they were doing this to us. But I was talking to lawyers, like, what do I get off my website? You know, what about all the samples that are already in the labs? What about the ones in transit? And at the last minute, the privacy commissioner and several lawyers said, look, this is simply unconstitutional. And so it's sitting still, loaded, ready to be passed, but it never did actually make it. So I feel like we have a communication problem. If the public knew more about this, they would simply reject the product, and these companies would do something else. They'd be fine. And the rural communities really thrive when there's wild fisheries, not farm fisheries. My community of 200 people, Echo Bay, we have 8 people left now, and we have 27 Norwegian feedlots with millions of Atlantics in it. They don't hire locals because we're trouble. And so I go around trying to communicate, and I'm continuing the testing. This is Sabra. She works with me, volunteer. This is Anissa and I working. We didn't know what we were doing in the beginning, but there's been a lot of helpful scientists that do know what they're doing with viruses. They've tuned up our protocol. We test relentlessly. We train people in circumstances where we can't get out to the grounds. And this guy tested for us. He did a couple of fish out on his fishing grounds. We've trained environmentalists. The First Nations are really concerned. They don't want to eat viruses. They can see differences in their fish. They can see fish are not returning. They're not sampling for us, but wherever we go, we train them how to do it. Because my thought is, we simply need to start doing this work ourselves. And DFO is still there, but you can do the work yourself, and you can go to society and you can say, this is the problem. This is just a good story. The CFIA, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, doesn't like our work, and they keep saying, you don't have chain of custody on your supermarket samples. You don't know where those Atlantic salmon came from. And they're right, we don't. Although we know from the beef scare going on right now that they can track it, but they choose not to. We got a little help from this bird. We were drifting around out in front of a salmon farm, and this guy hopped in the tote, and he grabbed this fish and took off, and now we're starting to get excited. Really heavy load for him. He's barely making it above the surface. He takes it to a rock, starts fighting over it with another bird, and darn it, they drop it in the ocean. But not before he'd ripped the head off and the necessary bits were lying on the rock. That fish, one fish out of that farm, had Piscine reovirus on the Fraser-Sockeye Migration Route. So the trouble with salmon farming is pretty basic. They break the natural laws. You cannot have a group of fish or any animal in one kind of a environment obeying one kind of rule and your wild guys outside, and they're exchanging pathogens. Because what the wild fish do, when they get sick, they die. In fact, before they die, they're removed. These wild salmon, every life stage, has half a dozen predators following them around. As soon as anybody starts to wobble, gone. And I mean, we did work on that at my research station. We had cutthroat trout and pink salmon with lice, pink salmon without lice. The trout nailed the ones with lice every time. Interesting thing about that trout is the lice would jump on him because he would T-bone the fish, and as he's handling it to get it down and swallow it, the lice would jump on the fish. And the researcher loved cutthroat trout, and he put the guy in a little plexiglass box like this, and that trout would hold perfectly still while he picked the lice off the tweezers. These guys are built to move. If they could be in a bay by the millions, they probably would be doing that. So just a couple of more things. The work I'm doing is considered controversial. But actually, I'm just confirming what was already known. Back in 1986, we had Dave Narver with the Ministry of Environment, wonderful man. He said, government has made a commitment to support aquaculture, but surely not at the risk of a nearly billion-dollar resource in the wild salmon fisheries of British Columbia. The direction the aquaculture industry wants us to go will ensure that we import unwanted diseases that can have impact on government hatcheries and wild stocks. Dave, you were right. Pat Chanute, Director General. So this is the most senior DFO official in British Columbia. He said, continued large-scale introductions from areas of the world, including Washington State, Scotland, Norway, even Eastern Canada, would eventually result in the introduction of exotic disease agents, of which the potential impact on both cultured and wild salmonids in BC could be both biologically damaging to the resource and economically devastating to its user groups. It was economically devastating to British or to Echo Bay to lose its salmon. There's 8 people left. This, the Maritimes, know about economically devastating with those cod. And I hear the herring and the scallops. And I go to these communities throughout Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, and they're very worried about their lobsters. I was in one guy's kitchen a couple of days ago on Grand Manan, and his wife actually said, I hope our children leave. It was very sad to hear that. And a fellow from Norway came over from the Norwegian Parliamentary Committee on the Environment, and he said, we're very strict about the quality of the environment questions. Therefore, some of the fish farmers went to Canada. They said, we want bigger farms, we can do as we like. That's a very hot subject, I think. So these guys knew what was going on long before I did. So, there you are, you're a biologist. You've moved into the wilderness because you're not really keen on talking to a lot of people, and you're studying killer whales. It's really fantastic. And then this thing happens to you, and the fishermen come to you because you're the only person in the community with a word processor, and they want you to fix it. And it turns out I must be related to Jack Russell Terrier or something because I just can't give this up. And so among the things I've tried is I've taken Marine Harvest in Canada and the province to Supreme Court, BC Supreme Court, and we actually changed the jurisdiction because it's unlawful for salmon farms to be regulated by the province. Funny thing is, it's still regulated by the province here. I got it switched to the federal government in British Columbia, but honestly, I only made it worse. I've done a lot of media. I've been on, you know, the cover of the New York Times Science page and the front of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and all kinds of shows. But it hasn't changed anything in the water. The farms are still there. The fish still have lice. ISA virus appears to still have gotten to BC. I turned my home in Echo Bay into a research station, the Salmon Coast Field Station, and invited students, anybody to come and work at cost. All we want is just cost. And that was very successful for a while on sea lice. There's one person here from that suffered the primitive nature of the station there. And this is still a very important thing, I think, to do, because if you don't have the measurements on something, you're not going to be able to save it. I went to Norway and I went to the AGMs for the two companies in the Broughton, the two big ones. And that was where I really changed my mind about salmon farming. Prior to that, I always thought there was room for it. But on the last night that I was in Norway, the CEO for Marine Harvest, the biggest company in the world and in British Columbia, she's a woman my age, she's very nice, she invited me in her office and she goes, "Morten, what do you want?" And I said, "You gotta get off the migration routes." And she just said, "Look, you know, I can't do that. I have to make the share price of this company go up 4 times a year. I cannot control the price, but I can control the number of farms, the number of fish, and that's what I'm doing." She said, "We can't survive if we don't have, if we don't grow." And at that moment, you know, the thought came I just thought, this is like cancer. They're going to grow and grow and grow. They are never going to be content at any one size. And that is the dangerous thing. If it was a private business with a couple of little companies, like I met on Grand Manan, there's two small companies there, and those guys said, "You know what? I lose these two sites, I'm done." Okay, that's a whole different thing. But you have an international corporation based on the share price. That is a phase mismatch with the biological world that is not working out for us. So I've tried a lot of things and none of them have worked. But one of the funner things was a group of us walked 500 kilometers down Vancouver Island a couple of years ago. And we invited all the people in the communities to come and walk with us. And by the time we got to the capital, there was 5,000 people there. It had absolutely no effect. It was really. That's great. So DFO is protecting trade, not wild fish, which is not a bad thing, but it's good for people to know. The provinces are the landlords. What now? If we want wild fish, it's up to us. And so I have this concept, the Department of Wild Salmon, which is all of us. And this is specific to British Columbia, but it could be happening here with the other fisheries. And you just do the work yourself. And very, very importantly, we need to pick up this tool, genomic profiling. I am trying to start a lab in British Columbia where I'm going to be able to go, perhaps not to Dr. Miller, but somebody with this tool. Because you've got any population of anything that's in trouble, sample it, see what it's fighting. It's got to be the first line of defense, figuring this out. The sea lice work I was doing was like, you know, working with a sledgehammer instead of tweezers. I was looking at fish that were dying. I was like, okay, they died of the lice. But she would be able to see the immune response of those fish flick on like that, first lice that got on the fish. Incredibly powerful. You got the Fraser River. If you just tested them every 100 kilometers all the way down the Fraser River and up the West Coast, you could go back to society and you could say, okay, you know what? Doing pretty good here, losing a few here. Oh, boing. We're losing 90% right here. You get a finer resolution, figure out, remember, this will only tell you what tools the fish is using, so you're gonna have to do some guesswork, but you could get in there and figure it out. Then you could change that, and you could go back the next year and see if it worked. It's so powerful, we've got to pick it up. And the other is to really harness the local knowledge. So this is Ricky Hallett I met a few days ago in this whirlwind tour in Jordan Bay. He worked with DFO. He's holding up a vial of lobster larvae that he got on the DFO boat when he was working with them. He's been fighting fish farms for 3 years. People like this are a wealth of knowledge. And if we work together, and in the case of salmon, we use the same sampling techniques, you send the samples to a single lab, or a couple of labs, and then you start modeling them mathematically, we will outmatch DFO very, very rapidly. The wild salmon, the wild fish are dying of politics. There are no superheroes that dive in here and help us. If we want these things, we're going to have to do it ourselves. So thanks very much, and if you have any questions...
everyone for your response and for coming here. We would like to invite